From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 248, recorded live Thursday, January 6th, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks about executable specifications with Goiko Adzik, Jonas Bondi, and Aslak Helisoy.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. We've got an international show today with a lot of people and a cast of thousands. I'm very excited about this show. We're going to be talking about executable specifications and specification by example. We've got a group from all over the place. We've got Aslak Helisoy, who comes from London, but I guess you're in Chicago right now. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I'm originally born in Norway, so all over the place.
Fantastic. And then you work on Cucumber. But you consider yourself, which is a Ruby tool, but you're a language agnostic software developer.
Yeah, I've done mostly Ruby and Java, and now lately quite a lot of JavaScript, some .NET, and some, you know, I try to stay language agnostic. I think that's the best way to be a developer.
So a Norwegian army knife, as it were.
Trying to be that.
Okay, and then we're going to learn about what Cucumber is. It seems like all these new exciting tools have new and exciting names. So Aslak is going to share with us what Cucumber. Then we've got Goiko Adzik from the UK right now. Is that right? You're in London somewhere? Or where are you located?
Yes. At the moment, I'm in London. I'm originally from Serbia, so you have quite an international show today, but I'm in London at the moment.
Okay. And then you work on fitness, but you also are a kind of tool and software agnostic.
I've contributed bits to fitness and bits to other tools, but I try to be tool and language. I try to learn as many tools and languages as I can.
Mm-hmm. And you also are, have you finished your book, Specification by Example?
That's actually been finished since August or September, but it's not coming out till May. Don't ask me why.
Okay, but we're going to all look forward to that book, Specification by Example,
yeah,
by Goiko. And then Jonas Bondi from Switzerland. Is that where you're located right now?
Yes, I'm from Bern, Switzerland.
And then Jonas works on SpecFlow, which is, I think, is on version 1.5 right now?
Yes, that's the latest version.
Okay, so Aslak, Goiko, and Jonas. I want to understand what this movement is towards specification, what they call executable specifications. I'm used to writing specifications in Microsoft Word. And I've always said when I was an architect at a large enterprise that writing specifications in Word is unfortunate because a Word document can't break the build. I've said before that a Word document has no teeth. And I've always wondered how I could somehow compile my Word document, because it usually just ends up being something that's not read. Who can give me kind of a starting statement about why that's a bad thing and what we're going to do about it? Perhaps Goiko could give us a sense of...
Yeah, I'll probably start with that one. So, as you said, you know, a Word document doesn't have any teeth, and generally the traditional models of specifications and tests in software processes are completely disconnected from the implementation. And what this, I wouldn't call it a movement, it's more sort of a set of ideas that's been implemented by lots of people in different contexts, is to actually make things really precise using examples so that anything that needs to blow up blows up sooner, so that we don't get into functional gaps and inconsistencies once we start implementing software, but we get it a bit sooner, and we get to that collaboratively with our domain experts, business analysts, testers, developers. Everybody sort of discusses these examples. Once something needs to be implemented, then we try and make it precise like that. And then once we have these examples, what's really interesting is that the examples are perfectly precise and testable. So we can take these examples we've used to illustrate our specifications, our requirements, and to make them more precise and automate them as tests and sort of collapse the whole gap between the specifications and tests and development in the middle. And that's how we can give these specifications some teeth, because if we have enough of these examples and they're universally understood and discussed, everybody knows what they need to do, so we build up a shared understanding. But also we get a set of these automated examples, automated specifications, and executable specifications, as sort of you've called them. And then basically you can eliminate the problem of people not reading specifications, because if somebody hasn't implemented something, it's going to break the build. You can eliminate the problem of functional regression, because if somebody's messed up something that was working before, you'll break the build, and so on. And then when you have that, and when the system is continuously validated against a set of requirements illustrated using examples, you get also something very interesting. You get a living documentation system for your software that basically is as reliable as the code, but it's much easier to read if done properly, and business users can access that. So you get a proper way to build up your business process documentation as well as you're building software, which is something that lacks quite often. And if you have that, teams that have that have found that it improves their effectiveness in so many ways that it's absolutely a must-have if you want to release frequently every week or every day and keep doing that in the next couple of years.
So
there's my statement. So, Aslak, what do you think about that? Is that a good description?
I think that's a great description. There's one thing that I would like to add, and this is a problem that I've come up with throughout my entire career, and that's the problem that you get with text, you know, Word documents, or you know, any other kind of document that is just read by humans. The problem is very often that they leave a lot of room for interpretation, and then a result of that is misunderstanding. So the person writing the requirements is thinking about one thing, and the person reading them doesn't necessarily interpret them in the same way that the writer intended. And that's how you get a lot of bugs or missing requirements, things like that.
An impedance mismatch, a disconnect where we all thought we were on the same page. We went and we wrote the thing, and then the business user is like, that's not at all what I said. How could you not understand? And then we
exactly.
have to write it again.
So by making it executable, you eliminate the risk of misunderstanding, because you actually have a computer program telling you whether it's working the way it's written or not.
Jonas, do you think that this is something that a business user is going to write themselves? I mean, do you see them opening up one of these tools and writing this prose, or is this simply something for them to consume?
I think it depends. In the beginning, that's at least my experience, the business user is not able to write it and doesn't want to write it. But once he does see that this executable specification really is bound to the implementation and really has an effect on the system, then I think a lot of business users or business analysts can see the value of the whole specification by example, and they can even start writing the specification by themselves.
Can I jump in again?
Of course.
So the question you asked is a very valid question, and I completely agree with Jonas in terms of the business analysts can actually do that themselves. I have a strong argument why they shouldn't. And I think, the most teams that failed with specification by example or behavior-driven development or agile acceptance testing or whatever sort of the name we put on this fail because they complain that, you know, their business users don't want to use a particular tool and write their specifications. I think this is completely sort of a misunderstanding of the process. And I think Aslak made a very strong point on creating a shared understanding, but the shared understanding comes from conversation. It doesn't come from somebody sitting down and writing stuff. So if a business analyst sits down and writes things in examples, it's a bit better than if they write it down as a Word document, but that still doesn't guarantee that all the testers have contributed what they want to contribute, and that all the developers have contributed what they want to contribute to the specifications. Where the way I see this process really working well is actually having this conversation about examples on a whiteboard, and then After we have these examples and a discussion, whoever the question of who then takes the results of the whiteboard and puts it in a tool is largely irrelevant.
Hmm.
I think actually at this point it would be maybe useful to give an example of what we mean by example.
Yeah, I would like to understand these different terms, because for someone who may be listening, who may not, again, speak English as their native language, they start hearing words like feature, scenario, example, and these could all be thought of as the same word. And I think that precision in software is very important, and certainly with code, if it compiles, then you know you have some syntax correct at least. But when you're writing prose in the form of English in a certain syntax, it can be very confusing. So can you guys, someone explain to me feature, scenario, example, and we'll start moving a little bit into implementation, because the clarity, I think, is what we're trying to get, a shared understanding through clear use of language.
Okay, I'll give it a try. So a compiler will tell you whether the code compiles correctly. Now, it doesn't tell you whether it's behaving correctly, right? The only person who can really tell you whether it's behaving correctly is the people who asked for that particular functionality. Or we call functionality, we often call it feature. So what people who practice ATDD or BDD or specification by example often do is, like Goiko said, they have a conversation. And the way this often happens is, let's take an example. Let's say, sign up for a mailing.
Well, they always use banking as the example. Whenever I see specifications that start using BDD or behavior-driven development, they use banking. So someone's trying to sign up for an account at a bank.
Right, exactly. So somebody's trying to sign up for an account in a bank, and various things can happen when they try to sign up. So the developers, then they will go to the stakeholders or the people who traditionally write the requirements, and they'll say, well, give me an example of what would happen when somebody signs up, right? And then maybe the other person would say, well, they enter their social security number and their address, and then they hit save. That's it. But then a developer or the tester will go, well, yeah, but then what? What do you expect to happen? Oh, well, that depends. Okay. Well, what does it depend on? Well, it can depend, for example, on their credit history. If they have a really bad credit history, we don't want them to be able to open an account.
Okay.
So that's going to add, so that we're going to go and refine the example and say, well, we can say, given that we have a person with a great credit history, and he fills in a social security number 356873, and then presses save, then he should be greeted with a message, you know, welcome to the bank. But then we can have another example where we say the same, except instead we say a person with a horrible credit history.
Right,
and then
right.
They should be greeted with, I'm sorry, we can't serve you at this time.
Okay, so let me see if I understand this. So the feature is the ability to sign up for a new account.
And exactly.
There are different scenarios for a person who wants to sign up for an account. One scenario would be a good credit history. Another scenario would be a bad one. So scenarios branch off of, are all potential things for a feature owner to think about.
Yes, the different ways that particular feature could behave depending on circumstances.
Okay. That's a feature different from an example?
An example is essentially the same as a scenario. People use those terms. They exchange those terms. They mean more or less the same thing.
Okay. I noticed that there's a lot of different systems for one to write these specifications in, but and forgive me if I misuse the terms, but it seems that there is this underlying syntax. Is it correct that this syntax is called Gherkin, and there are different implementations of that, where SpecFlow is one for the .NET folks, and Cucumber is one for the Ruby folks, but this syntax, where did that syntax come from?
That syntax is an evolution of the way you write tests in fitness, but it's also an evolution of the way a lot of people in the Agile community were writing user stories on just paper index cards. So it's taking ideas from one tool and one way that people just express themselves, and putting it into a grammar and a tool.
Mm-hmm.
So this has evolved into a language which is called Gherkin.
So it's worth saying that Gherkin is probably one of the most popular ways of specifying these things, but it's not necessarily the only way. And in terms of other ways to specify that, for example, there's a tool called Concordion, which allows you to use specification, by example, on freeform HTML. So you mark up what are expected inputs and what are inputs and expected outputs in freeform HTML, and you don't have to use any particular syntax or language for that. And there are other tools, for example, Fitness, that are more table-oriented. And Ward Cunningham even had an example of a tool that's based on visual swim lanes for Eclipse that's also specifying approval workflows for the Eclipse tool, feature process, approval process, something like that, using visual swim lanes. So it's not the language itself is quite important, I think, but it's more important to fit it to a particular project.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools on the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, TeamPulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself. Get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/TeamPulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us.
So as I understand it, a number of years ago, when Fit and Fitness started to think about executing something that was a little different from code, the idea of executing user stories kind of came up. Is that correct? And then there was a thing called RSpect and a story runner. People wanted to run stories. So then Dan North did some work on that, and a lot of different people were involved. If you can look up at the Qx.info website, there's a whole list of people who kind of had a number of conversations about this this language, this meta language that started to kind of happen. And both the SpecFlow website and the Qx website have really interesting homepages, and right there on the homepage you've got some examples. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that, because the language is precise, but at the same time it's very flexible. I see here, just looking at the very first example on the Cucumber website, that says describe behavior in plain text, which is a little bit of a fib, because you do have a structure, but then you do have free form. You can say, here's a scenario, and you could say then anything you want. You have the word scenario, and then you write whatever you want. Can you even write it in any language? Does it have to be in English after you say scenario?
You can write it in Chinese, or in Hebrew, or in Arabic, Norwegian. There's 40 different languages you can write it in.
40 different languages. So the general structure is, I'm putting this in the context of what I know, because I think people who are listening are probably familiar with test-driven development, at least more than behavior-driven, and they think about things in terms of arrange, act, assert, when they structure their unit tests. And when you are doing your executable specs, you say given, possibly and, but it's usually given, when, then, seems to be the general structure. And those are the keywords, and then anything after that is prose, like, as you said, in any one of 40 languages.
Yeah, that's right. So the Gherkin language, it comes in 40 different flavors. You know, it's translated to 40 natural languages. English obviously being the most common one. So you have
there's I don't remember how many keywords, but there's essentially five keywords and some synonyms. That's feature, scenario, and then given, when, then. So each scenario, you can have as many scenarios as you want in a feature. And each scenario, you can have as many lines starting with given, when, and then. So that's the constraint of the language. You have to start a line with one of those five keywords. But then you can say whatever you want after that. So you can say scenario, colon, bad credit history. And then you can say, on the next line, you can say, given I have a person with bad credit history, when he signs up, then he's not served.
And how important is that text? Does that, can that be, I understand that in my experience working with folks in this space, they're very picky about what, how that's structured. So even though it's free form, the people that I've worked with have been extremely, uptight, let's say, about that. How important is it?
Well, I mean, so remember that Gherkin serves two purposes. It, one is that it should be readable by people who don't know how to program. But at the same time, it needs to be executable by an interpreter, which is SpecFlow if you're using .NET, or Cucumber if you're using Ruby or Java. So there needs to be some structure in there, but we try to make it as little as possible so that it wouldn't alienate people who... We don't want people to think about it as a programming language, although technically it is, but it's like camouflaged as prose.
So one of the things is that now that you've written this, like, for example, given they have $10 in their account, really what's important out of that that sentence is the $10, because that's potentially something you could put into the test. And so then you're going to want to extract things out of that. So perhaps Jonas can say something about that. Once you've described that behavior in the plain text, you need a bridge between your tests to actually pull that out. How do you get that information that, that might be buried inside of that sentence, in that prose, and get that into your into code so you can start moving around with it?
Yes, there has to be another step that is usually done by the developer. He binds the executable specification to the implementation of the system, and these are called step implementations or bindings. And in these bindings, he can access the plain text of the executable specification and extract the values he needs. This is basically done with the regexp.
Now, see, and this is the part where things fall down, because I think that the idea of deriving development with the business behavior seems really, really positive. And it's a beautiful system, and a lot of people have said that they feel very confident in their systems when they have a large number of executable specifications. But then when I hear that there's a regular expression involved, it's just kind of a, on the internet, we would say a bit of a sad trombone. You know, wah, 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 kind of that that comes up. Is there any way to get around that, that little bit of implementation detail?
Why do you think that's a trombone?
Because regular expressions feel very fragile.
Yeah, well, so regular expressions, you know, it's a language of its own, and they can be used for many different things. And, you know, if you look at some Perl code or... maybe some Ruby or Python code, or very often you'll see complex regular expressions in there because, you know...
Well, Perl's a sad trombone in itself. That's another whole show.
But that doesn't mean that every regular expression has to be illegible. So, you know, not readable. So, in let's say you're using SpecFlow. You will have, for each step, you would have just a C-sharp method, and you will use an attribute... with a regular expression attached to it, but that regular expression is going to look pretty much exactly the same as a line in your executable specification. Just with it's actually only if you want to extract special values that you have to use stuff like backslash d to extract an int, or dot star to extract a string.
So it may not be as bad as I think it is. You're really just parameterizing. You'll have the same sentence again, except you'll replace, you'll tokenize the sentence. So
Yeah, we're not going to be writing complicated regular expressions.
Even somebody who isn't familiar with regular expressions will pick it up really, really quickly. And another nice thing is that both Cucumber and SpecFlow, they will actually create little snippets for you that will get you started with a correct regular expression that you can later tweak if you need to. But you get a lot of help on the way. Am I right there, Jonas? SpecFlow does create those snippets as well, right?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
So, again, you know, as I said, lots of people, in particular developers, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody else because I messed up massively on my first project when I tried to do this, focus on a tool. They focus on the fact that something has regex or something has tables or something has something else, where that's not where the big value is. The tool is there very importantly to automate this. But, you know, if lots of developers just focus on a tool and they start implementing a tool, that's what they want to do because that's what people are used to doing. You know, you have a problem, you find a tool to solve it, you implement the tool, and hey presto, where this thing really doesn't work like that. And the book you mentioned that sort of is written but is not coming out yet is my research on I've interviewed about 50 teams that have gotten really big payoffs from BDD and acceptance testing and things like that. And all of them, most of them said that in the beginning they started implementing a tool and then they understood that this is a completely wrong way to go and that you have to go and look at the communication in the team, look at the dynamics of the team, look at the process as a whole. And then once you've improved it, then the tool fits in. So, you know, the people who complain about regexes and people who complain about unwieldy step definition systems and things like that often misuse these tools to do technical testing, to do unit testing in Cucumber or unit testing in Fitness, because that's what developers are used to do without communicating to anybody else. Where if you do this properly, then through collaboration you get to examples, and then automating that shouldn't be a problem. As Aslak said, you know, these things are automatically generated quite often, and the entry point to the glue code can be automatically generated. And from my experience, none of the teams that have actually implemented any of the tools have problems with regexes. That's just a non-issue. That's a complaint from somebody that doesn't implement the process properly, and they're getting problems because of that, not because of regexes.
I think that's a great point, Goko. You know, like you said, it's very important to say. It's a good, very good point that it isn't the whole process of writing executable specifications isn't really about the tool. You know, some tools happen to be more popular than others, but I know a lot of teams who have just made their own little tool that fits their purpose perfectly. You know, some people can use Excel. It really depends on what kind of domain you're working in. And I think where people who haven't done this are keen to try it out, I think they should actually start by walking over and, you know, starting the conversation between a domain expert, a tester, and a developer, and just use a whiteboard and figure out how could we write down examples for this new feature that we're about to develop, and do it on the whiteboard, and then you'll figure out that in some domains you will do this with a couple of tables. In other domains, you will use the given when then form, or maybe you come up with your own way of doing it. And once you figure out a good way to describe a scenario or an example in a concise, non-ambiguous way, then you can pick a tool, and not the other way around.
I think that that's extremely good examples. I think that remembering that it's often programmers who pick these tools. They think that a tool is going to solve some problem, so they Google for the tool, they find the tool, they download the tool, and then they try to implement the tool, as opposed to implementing the system and thinking about why is it that I am doing this. And you can get so focused on the tool that you even forget why you tried to implement it in the first place. And I think that taking a tool like Cucumber or SpecFlow or any of the other tools and trying to use it to test unit testing, to test units of work, would probably be a really great way to get extremely frustrated with the system and just give up and then declare
this is useless. And then they would start making declarative statements like BDD is useless because I couldn't do unit testing in Cucumber.
Yeah, there's a lot of people, especially in the Ruby community, who use it as a unit testing tool. And that's like shooting sparrows with a cannon. It's definitely not a unit testing tool. It's a tool where you test from 10,000 feet. You're testing your system as a black box. You're not testing individual classes and methods. Now, technically, you can test classes and methods with it, but just don't do that.
So I like that you said testing at 10,000 feet. Jonas, if you were going to have a rich system with lots of, let's say, N unit tests, let's say you have several thousand N unit tests in a very large system, and then you're going to introduce something like this into an existing system, keeping in mind that at this point, tests have driven your development, not behavior driven development. You know, is there going to be like a ratio that you would have? Is there some number of unit tests to, I don't know if you'd call these integration tests or or specifications?
Acceptance tests.
Acceptance tests?
I think we would call it acceptance tests. That's the best term.
Okay. Is there like a rule of thumb that for every one?
I don't have any rules of in terms of numbers. I wanted to highlight the kind of workflow that is used, I think, also with Cucumber a lot. That's this outside-in development approach.
Okay.
That is the test. You're trying to take the test driven to a higher level of abstraction with acceptance test driven. And as you start in test driven with a test and then write the code until you write the test that is failing and then write the code until the test is green, you take that to the next abstraction level and you start with an end-to-end test with an acceptance test. And then you dive into the inner circle, and there you start with unit tests, and unit tests drive writing your code and your classes. And at some point, your end-to-end test is getting green. And at this point, you have coded enough, and you can start with a new end-to-end test. And that's this outside-in approach that I think is propagated with Cucumber and also with Specflow.
And also other tools like Concordian and Fitness and any
true,
other.
True, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, in regards to numbers, I don't know. You know, it really depends. 50-50, 80-20, 20-80, you know. It's,
really?
It's really you can't really give a...
I'm going to quote you on
really
that.
Give a ratio.
I think it could even be sensible to have a system that only have acceptance tests if you are not going to be test-driven. I mean, that's maybe a bit heretic, but I also think it's important to see that the acceptance tests are mainly concerned with the external quality of the system, that the system really does what it should do. And tests, unit tests at a really fine granularity are mainly concerned with the internal quality of the system, that the code has some good qualities, and you can assure that with your unit tests. But these are more or less orthogonal, so you can have your own mixture and you have to define it for your project, how it is working out.
So I don't know who exactly said this. It's not me, because I've quoted it in my previous book. But there's a very good quote that says that unit tests tell you that you've built the system right, and acceptance tests tell you that you've built the right system.
Yeah.
So as Donna said, you know, these two things are sort of orthogonal, and you do need both, because with only unit tests, you don't know whether you've done what your customers want you to do. And with only acceptance tests, you know that you've done something wrong, but it's harder to find the problems, because unit tests are finer grained, and unit tests help you pinpoint technical problems much easier. So I think in practice, most teams that I've interviewed actually use both, and quite a few teams actually sort of had to implement TDD on a unit level to go one level above and expand it to business functionality. So that's a very common path to BDD or acceptance testing or specification, by example. I've interviewed a couple of teams that have actually implemented this on, say, legacy systems, where there were no unit tests below, but they've started to implement specification workshops and then try to implement some automated tests around that, and they have no unit tests at all. They only have acceptance tests at this point. And so that kind of thing does work, but it's harder to pinpoint problems technically than it is if you have unit tests as well.
I have also seen that last example several times in my experience, and that you have legacy systems and somehow the whole development wants to get to a more automated way of living, and they start with these acceptance tests because there is no way to have unit tests on all the legacy code base, and then they started with this outside in approach with new features they implemented.
Yeah, and I think that's often a lot easier to set up as well, because if you it's easier to, let's say you have an old legacy system with very, very tightly coupled code, which is often the case. It's going to be very hard to just inject a unit test in there, because very often you have to instantiate 50 classes just to run one test. Whereas poking the system from the outside with an acceptance test is all often a lot easier, especially if you're writing tests after the fact. Now, I think a good rule of thumb, if you're starting from scratch and trying to do things the right way, the more complex the business rules are of your system, the more you need unit tests. If you have a very simple application, let's say like a CRUD web app, maybe all you need is a high-level acceptance test, you know, to take it to the other extreme. Because you don't have all of these edge cases you need to test for, or at least not as many as you would with something really complex. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that that's a very good point. I think that we're getting as we're circling the drain a little bit, as they say. That what's the term that they talk about when Michelangelo is trying to create something, that he's got this rock and he knows that the sculpture is in there, so he just needs to remove rock. It feels the same way with these kinds of things. Like people continue to search for the answer, but in fact, the answer is in negative space. You know, people can tell you what something is not more than they can tell you what it is. But ultimately, you need to keep in mind, why are we doing this? We are doing this to solve a business problem. We're trying to make a good experience for users, and the tool is secondary. That sounds like that focus, even for professionals, needs to a reminder needs to happen for even professionals. I suppose that you guys as pros find yourselves in large systems, just reminding yourselves with a little bit of a reset, communication reset, saying, "All right, why are we doing this again? I think we're misusing our tests." Well, we're running out of time, but I want to thank everyone. I want to thank Aslak Helisoy, who has joined us from Chicago, Goiko Adzik, and also Jonas Bondi, and we'll go and put up links to Cucumber, links to Goiko's book, and links to SpecFlow all up on the site. And then please join the conversation at hanselminutes.com. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.